Hello, and welcome to Major Revisions, a podcast for early career ecologists by early career ecologists. I'm Grace Wilkinson, and with me as always is Jeff Atkins and John Walter. How are you both doing?
Living the dream.
Doing excellent.
Fantastic. So,
Grace?
Yeah?
I have a story for you.
Yeah?
John and I are co-authoring a manuscript with another colleague of ours, Atticus Stovall, friend of the show. And we had this issue where... good-naturedly, of course, but we kind of all came to, like, we all have kind of equal contributions to this manuscript, and we couldn't really decide a very clear way or logical way to figure out who should actually be the first author on this manuscript. And so we kind of went back and forth on it, like, oh no, and everyone's like, oh no, you should do it, or no, you should do it, it makes this sense. And John's finally like, we should do this in the most random way that we can think. Let me think on this all day. So John hits up the Slack later, like, hey, I have this idea. And being the avid Twitter user that I am, I'm like, okay, yeah, I like this idea. This is a great idea, but we should throw it out to Twitter to make it even more random. The idea was to take the first letter in our last names, so mm-hmm. W-A-N-S, and to find a song, and just the first... you know, first letter of the first word that has that in it. So the first one, if it's a W, S, or an A in the word, that person becomes first author.
What if the first word is was?
Then it would have been Walter.
Okay.
Yeah. So if the first word was and, it would have been me. Like, okay. Whatever the first word that shows up in that song, right? Try to make it as random as possible. Does that make sense, though? The heuristic here?
Yes.
Okay. So just make it random. So we... put it out as a tweet and just like, hey, first person, we need your help. Reply to this with any artist and song. Doesn't matter. Just something like on Spotify so we can find it and track it down. Give us an author. Give us a song. And like 25 minutes went by. Nobody. I was kind of panicking in a way because it was also kind of exciting because it's like, let's throw out this relatively, not like a major life decision, right? Like, we're not naming kids or dogs or anything, but it's still like, you know, it shows up and like for the rest of our lives, it's going to be on like a CV. And so like, it's important, right? It's non-trivial. Nobody replies. And then finally, like actually a postdoc over in the University of Virginia, she replied and sent a song by the band, and so we all like frantically go to like, you know, genius.com at the same time to look it up, and if it comes to review, you'll be finding, you know, Walter et al. 2019 pretty soon here, but
we hope
hopefully if it goes to review quickly. But mad thanks to Claire Griffin over at UVA for being the one who suggested the song The Harvest by the band. But I highly recommend, if you need to solve major life problems with some type of random walk model, that you use Twitter.
Which is about as random as it can possibly get.
So if BuzzFeed or anybody wants to write us and write an article about, like, you won't believe what these scientists did, you can reach us. I'm at Atkins Jeff on Twitter, and John is at EcoJaw, and also at Stovall Atticus. You can reach us, and we'll be glad to give interviews and everything. So we'll be looking forward to hearing from you.
Oh my gosh.
What have y'all been up to?
You know, not much. The semester is upon us. My students are taking their first exam on Tuesday. So,
Can I take it with them? Is this limnology?
It is limnology. You definitely should.
All right, Tuesday, I want to take this exam. What time is your class meet?
It meets from, 9:30 to 10:50 Central. Why did I have to think about that? Oh my God.
I swore on the show previously that I would take your exam, and if I scored a passing grade, I would get a limnology sticker. So,
perfect.
9:30 Tuesday.
I will send it. I will make sure that it is being proctored. Thusly, could you find someone, you know, to watch you, make sure you don't cheat?
No, you're going to have to take me on honor system on this, but I'll videotape myself doing it.
All right, that sounds good. There is no honor system at Iowa State. I miss that from UVA.
I'll live stream it on Twitch. I don't know how that works, but my 8-year-old can show me. I realize it's like, since I moved to Richmond, what's great is I can go into my office every day, and it's awesome. But I get there at like 7:20, 7:30. No grad students show up until like 11.
Sounds right.
Or like 10:30. So I have like 3 hours unfettered. Nobody in the morning.
That sounds amazing.
Awesome. It's awesome. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I'd love that.
Highly recommend.
To be fair, we were those grad students once too.
Yeah, that's true.
And now I find myself, you know, being at the office at 8 a.m. and being like, I have a question. Where are people? and then reminding myself that that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I didn't think I would ever become a morning person. Now I wake up every morning at 6 o'clock and I hate myself for it.
Is that like you just happen to wake up at 6 o'clock or your life dictates that you wake up at 6 o'clock?
My life dictates that I do it. The other day I was doing yoga.
What?
It's weird, well, man. I don't know. It just felt right, you know? My kid wanted to buy kombucha the other day. We went to Whole Foods. That was only because it was right next to the gym, so it was, like, right there. But that's where we bought the kombucha, because, you know, that's how that works. It sucks. Yeah, I hate it. But I started, like, a tattoo fund again, so I think this is my counter to this, is that I plan on being fully tattooed in, like, 2 or 3 years, so.
Nice.
Yeah.
Can we maybe have a listener poll for, like, your first face tattoo?
I don't think I'm going to go that far.
Then what's the point? You said fully tattooed.
I would get, like, a lip tattoo. What would you want to get a tattoo inside my lip? It has to be, like, letters, though.
Right, so you can, like, pull it down and be real badass?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Cool, I can see that.
Yeah, I can do that.
I think that should be a listener contest. I'm just saying.
Well, I mean, we haven't, like, come through on the last two listener contests.
Right,
I haven't come through.
This is, the points are made up and the prizes don't matter, right? So our listeners should recognize that by now.
For the record, the author thing, I told a friend of mine what we were doing, and she was like, oh my god, you're such dudes. John was like, is that a compliment? And I was like, I think it's pretty neutral, but it's not inaccurate either. So, you know, it's fine.
There you go. Well, so speaking of manuscripts and thinking about publishing and them and whatnot, this is an opportunity for segue right now. Just trying to bring you that snappy production quality. So tonight we were going to talk about the cost of publishing, right? And article publishing charges. So part of this has to do with open access, but it's not exclusively that. But a lot of this was fueled by a blog post that was published by Josh Schimmel, right? Josh Schimmel, we wish was a friend of the podcast. And
he could be a friend. We just don't know yet.
That's very true. If you are, please reach out.
Oh, if he did, he would have written an angry blog post about us. Actually, his blog posts aren't angry. I like his blog post.
No, they're very well reasoned. I like that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So along those lines, the title of this blog post, right, was Why Does It Cost $2,000 to Publish a Paper? And John, I think you have a pretty succinct summary of it. So I'm just like, go ahead.
Yeah, so this is my one sentence summary. It's that infrastructure has non-trivial but non-obvious costs, and authors who publish bear those costs, even though rejected manuscripts also incur them.
Yeah, so what are some of those non-trivial but non-obvious costs that are the infrastructure?
Server farms. And software and people to develop and maintain that software. They get paid things.
Right, which on its face makes me go, oh my god, we're actually paying money for Scholar One. But, right, it could be worse.
Just think if you didn't have Scholar One.
Well, so, you know, the first paper I ever submitted was to a society journal. And this is going to sound like an old timer, but this is how rapidly publishing, I feel like, has been changing. The first paper I ever submitted was in late 2012, and it was to a journal that was for a society journal, and I emailed it to the editor-in-chief.
Wow.
It was an actual cover letter that was my email, and it was emailed to them. and they email me back my reviews. And I've never done that since.
I've never done that.
Yeah, it was very old school.
But very personal. That must have been a transitional period, because you and I started publishing around the same time, and I've never done that.
Yeah, this was the last year that ASLO was, the ASLO journals were run that way.
Wow.
And then they were switching over to a different model very soon after, when ASLO partnered with Wiley in 2015. Scholar One, and I'm forgetting the other major.
Manuscript Central.
Oh, thank you. But these things exist now, right? And so that's definitely part of those non-trivial costs. I think another one that Schimmel brought up in the blog post was legal services.
Yep.
Right?
Which I didn't think about. That's interesting. But it makes sense, obviously.
Yeah, and it's, you know, those lawyers understandably like being kept on retainer, so it's not a small fee. It's all the time. What were some of the other ones?
Well, like John said, like, you know, it's the cost. It costs money to handle every article, right? But you're subsidizing the ones that don't actually get published, which he does bring up an interesting ethical question, I think, with part of that. But hidden charges.
I mean, this one isn't all that hidden, but, you know, the editorial staff does, you know, cost money. You know, they have salaries.
Yeah, some do, yeah. Or even if it's just like a, you know, honorarium or something, depending on who it is. And,
well,
a lot of them, like, throw little shindigs at conferences and whatnot.
Well, and
small things.
So to be clear, you know, much of the editorial board is volunteer. The, you know, senior editors and editor-in-chief are typically, you know, typically receive a stipend. They're not typically, like, you know, full-time employees, but the journal does have employees often who are, you know, responsible for kind of managing the journal.
And the stipend of that editor-in-chief is rarely a full stipend of what a like well-respected scientist in our field would be being paid.
Oh, it's like,
it's a fraction.
In the order, yeah, it's in the order of like a few thousand to maybe like 10 to 20 most, right?
I think for at least some of the journals, I could be wrong, but I thought that for some of the ASLO journals, the editors-in-chief made 30,000. But I could be misremembering that. It's nothing. It's pittance comparatively. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's tens of thousands of dollars for an editor-in-chief of a, you know, well-respected society journal, flagship society journal. It's well less than, you know, a full salary.
So, and there was this idea that the, you know, rejected papers also incur these costs because they have to go through all of that management and whatnot as well. They're still part of the server farm, things like that. And so, as you all mentioned, there was this interesting ethical question that Schimmel posed about, well, should you pay to submit? So what did you all think about he argued against that, but what did you all think about that and just that question being posed in general, I guess?
I mean, I definitely, I don't think you can do it, because it definitely discourages, you know, anyone who's not from like a rich, well-funded R1 university or a rich, well-funded lab. Like, the number he arrived at is approximately $600. So if you had to pay $600 just to, you know, send an article in, that would deter you from doing it. It would deter you in from doing it a lot, you know. I guess the counter to that would say you would definitely pretty rapidly get rid of, I think, a lot of the least publishable unit approaches that some people would do, except for the richest, best funded labs. So I think you would just, you would probably get rid of that issue a lot, you know, I think in science, but you would also increase the disparity between the rich and the everyone else.
it would definitely still maintain the disparity, and I completely agree with you on that, and I don't think it's a good idea. But another thing it would potentially do as well would prevent the, okay, well, let's just start at the top and work our way down and submit this, end up submitting this paper to, you know, seven journals before it finds its home.
Which, I mean, that is a tragedy of the commons type problem, right? Like, there is an undue burden put on reviewers and, you know, AEs and editors in general from people who submit poorly prepared or unready manuscripts, or who are, like you said, working the system down, or who are doing least published one unit type approaches. That is a burden on the system. I'll take your silence as saying I made a very profound point. Good job, Jeff. Yeah.
You did. Actually, my audio cut out for a second, so I didn't hear that profound point. But let's edit through that and move on.
Took episode 64 before I made a good point. Grace didn't even hear it.
I'll re-listen.
No, it's cool. I was saying, like, people who, like, submit stuff, like, when it's not prepared well, you know, or who, like you said, working their way down the system, create an undue burden on the peer review and the editorial system, like all those of us volunteering, like having to do all this work for stuff that, you know, people aren't preparing well or aren't getting it where it needs to be, right?
Yeah.
The glut of publishing, it's a burden in a way. And if you want some way to make people, like you said, try to find the optimal journal, try to do their best effort to make things ready instead of just submitting it when they think it's good enough, to get like a review that's really just like a, you know, input to make the paper better. I don't think most people do that, but I think it exists.
Yeah. Well, but then you run up into that fundamental problem of the number of papers and where they're published is the currency of the land. And so, right. Yeah. Lots of systems to dismantle there to make that work. But so we're probably all, to some degree, on the open access train. By that I mean we're all pretty pro open access.
Yeah, I like it.
John?
Mostly.
Yeah.
I agree with a lot of the principles of open access. I am like wary of publishers that, you know, try and take advantage of that model. And I think that, and I don't just mean predatory publishing, I think that there are a number of publishers that kind of exist in a gray area where they're maybe not as rigorous as they ought to be. But they have a good enough reputation and publish good enough things that they, have, you know, kind of become, at least certain of their journals have become reputable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you there.
But, you know, the principle of, you know, people should be able to access science freely, you know, especially our, you know, government agencies who are actually trying to make decisions based on the science, and, you know, and oftentimes don't have, you know, subscriptions to tons of journals, you know, it does make a difference. And, you know, we should be trying to put our science in the hands of, you know, really anybody who wants to read it.
Absolutely. So I think you've articulated that right now just beautifully. So we all probably hold this ideal, this value, pretty closely. And so I guess my question is, when did you really start to think about, or when did it first hit you about the cost of actually executing that value, acting on that value every time you publish as best as you can?
Mine was from very early on, because all of my PhD is open access. So I think the very first one was the most expensive, because it was in Biogeosciences, which is an EGU journal. And it's open access, but it's done by the page. So the theory, you can pay infinite, I guess. And then the other two were Ecosphere, which is like 1250 at the time. So yeah, I realize it's kind of expensive. But like the back end of that is also like not only the cost of publishing, but sometime, Grace, you should sit down since you have a lab. You should figure out how much it costs to actually make the paper.
Oh, yeah.
Because the number we came up with was in the neighborhood between $50,000 and $60,000.
That seems low.
Just to write a paper.
Oh, just to write the paper. I was going to say, that seems low because like my salary.
Yeah, the data, the people, the staff, right. Yeah, all that, everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be lovely. And then you start thinking about these papers with long-term data. Millions. Just to get that data and information out there. But so,
yeah,
but
the
you
way
that
I work, that's the way that I work. Someone else has already sunk that cost.
Fair. But so Jeff.
But no, I remember like
yeah.
very early on, like getting the bill back for like charges and everything. I was like, oh my God, you know, and like still like, I mean, yeah, it depends on where you send stuff, but like it's expensive. And even like there are charges for ones that aren't even open access either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like AGU journals, I think, are on average like $1,000, and they're for non-open access. And you know, like certain, you know, charge for color. I guess they still have like a print issue, or you know, some there's charges for other things. But yeah, I mean, it's way more expensive than I thought it was, at least you know from the onset.
Yeah, but so when you were doing that, though, did you have conversations with your co-authors, like with your advisors, like talking about the, okay, we want to do this, but this is going to be way more expensive, right? Because like you said, all journals are becoming more expensive, and understandably, there's lots of costs associated with it. Like I understand that. But, you know, to at least particularly at the beginning of open access, I remember early on, you know, when there were projects that weren't that well funded, thinking about like, well, we have two papers to publish, so we can publish one of them open access and just get one published, or we can publish both of these and not have them be open access. It was like a conversation a couple of times.
Yeah, I've actually had that conversation more now, like in grad school. It was more like, okay, well, you know, we figure out ways to do this. And, you know, there was open access funds through the library very early on, but those were always depleted. Yeah, it was like funneling money around in grants, because it's not something that you write into grants. Or back then, it wasn't. I think it's something you actually kind of, some people do now. Like you can just physically around, like, yeah, we're gonna send this here, it costs this much, et cetera, et cetera. But to that point, like even within the open access framework, I think that can dictate where you send things to, right? Like, you know, if your ecology paper, like, you know, Ecosphere costs about $12.50 with a society discount. That's always an option. But then, like, was it Scientific Reports?
Like 1900?
5,200. Yeah, what there's one that's like 5,200. Maybe that's Nature Communications.
The Nature journals are really expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's stupid.
Like $5,000?
No, and I'll never send anything there that I, at least that I'm the first author on out of principle.
Yeah, it's just, that's astronomical to me. And it's, but it buy is like you're buying the fact that it says Nature Communications.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because it's they're published, correct me if I'm wrong with this, under the same theory that Scientific Reports and PLOS One use, that it's judged on just did you do this in a scientifically rigorous fashion? It's not based on novelty, it's not based on anything else. It's just like, did you do a good, you know, face science approach regardless of the outcome? If you did, cool.
Not Nature Communications.
Nature Communications is not? Okay, because Scientific Reports and PLOS One are basically like, did you check all the boxes?
Scientific cool. Reports,
publish it.
That is at least purportedly true. And Scientific Reports is published by the Nature group. But like Nature Communications, Nature Ecology and Evolution, like those titles all take novelty and fanciness into account.
Okay. It's honestly fucking hard to keep up with this shit.
So. Well, yeah, because the Nature group also adds like 6 new journals a year, so.
Right. there's new journals popping up for everything all the time, right? So this is just, I want to take a minor, like a moment, an aside to just plug and say, this is why we should always try to pick society journals when possible. Because they support your society, they are a brand that is associated with quality based on the best in your field, and there might be warts, but you as a society member actually have voting power and a say in how those things are run, right? So pick your society journal. Okay, I'm done now. I swear, I've been off the board for almost 3 years, and I still can't not.
Dude, I'm on your team on this one, though. It makes a difference to me, and it has a lot to do with how I choose journals.
Yeah, absolutely. Ditto.
Okay, question then. How do you pick where something goes? I say this because John and I talk about, you know, authoring the paper. We also have like long, in-depth conversations about like where are we going to go with this one. But Grace, how do you approach finding the home?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think it's first and foremost, it's the audience. Is who is this going to impact and be interesting and exciting to? And, you know, audience maybe sort of changes to some degree. You know, it's not the same way in which my advisor used to talk about audience because, you know, they literally get an ecology, you know, the issue of ecology is available in the library. Let's go read the table of contents. You know, it's not the same way anymore. But there is definitely, you know, there's all journals that we keep a better track of than others. So part of it's audience. And then definitely take into account whether or not it's a society journal. You know, so is there an audience that's also associated with a society that I'm a part of? And then at that point, I have the luxury at this point right now, who knows, in 6 months, and a year or anything, of just looking at not having to worry about publication costs, not having that be high up on the list right now. But it definitely will be at times. And then honestly, I start looking at who the actual publisher behind it is, whether it's Wiley or Elsevier or Springer. And that starts playing a role in my decision, too. I don't know. How about you all?
I think it's pretty similar. You know, I certainly have, like, certain, you know, a bias toward society journals and away from certain publishers. But... you know, fit and audience is really important. And like, I do pay attention to like what the publication fees are. You know, are there page charges? Is it an open access journal where there's a fee? You know, because I do a fair amount of work just, you know, by the nature of I do most of my work is either theoretical or using existing data. Like, I do a lot of stuff that's not directly grant funded. Like, there's something funding my time, but it's not a project that falls under a specific funding allocation where, you know, we have money set aside for you know, for those fees. And so I do have to be pretty cognizant of that. And I think earlier in my career, I could rely on mentors and collaborators more. And now, as I'm starting to be one of, you know, a official or like de facto PI or co-PI on more projects, I need to like be a lot more cognizant of where the money's coming from.
How about you, Jeff?
So I think the last few is that the group that I've been publishing the most with, we kind of had like targeted like different like higher tier journals, and like each like picked one. I was just trying to like spread out like what we were working on, because, you know, we had people from different backgrounds working on a larger project. So there was like somebody who's primarily a community ecologist, and somebody over here, and then, you know, me in ecosystems, and, you know, So we did, you know, divided up a project basically like that approach. We had somebody like targeting ecology letters and somebody else targeting, you know, nature/ecology. And then I'm submitting one to Eco Apps here in a little while. And so the idea was to kind of like focus different aspects of a project. I've struggled with some of these like kind of smaller side projects that I've been a part of that don't really necessarily have real clean outcomes, but also don't really have real clear avenues.
Yeah.
I think it's something I've struggled with as someone who does a lot of cross-disciplinary work and interdisciplinary work, that sometimes things just don't really have nice clean homes, and it's really like you have to weigh like how much time it is to try to redo the narratives of the actual papers to figure out where they fit. You know, like with my audience is this, then I need to think about shaping, you know, more sort of an ecological standpoint, or, you know, this thing that I've been working on this week. Like I sit down to write the introduction thinking it was going to look like one thing, and by the time I got done with it, I was like, this has like virtually no ecology in it. It's all like hardcore environmental science and you know, physical geography, which just, I think, probably made it more difficult, like where to send things. So I have trouble with those because I feel like it's either like a very clear cut thing, or it's just like, then it, if not, then it, there's like this liminal space,
right,
where you have like to think about the work, and like you said, who's the audience, and you know, or who do I want to see this, you know, like if I want it to be more physical scientists, then I think more of like the AGU journals, like JGR, like Journal of Geophysical Research, and subsequent. But if it's more ecology, then you think like the ESA Society journals, like ecology and whatnot. And it's all like how you kind of package and sell the work. Sometimes I'm envious of people who are like, you know, hardcore within one field, and it's just like, oh, we have like these two or three journals, and this is where we submit things. So I don't know.
Does that happen in ecology?
I don't know. I'm thinking maybe we all build straw man arguments, right? That's mine.
But, you know, well, go ahead, Jen.
I mean, I just, like, you know, I feel like in ecology, we have a number of tiers of relatively, like, general ecology journals. And, like, I know that we've talked before about, like, how... Ecology Letters doesn't publish as much ecosystem ecology and biogeochemistry as it could. But, like, that's sort of, like, one... I guess, like, Ecology Letters, Ecology, you know, Oikos, Ecologia, they all kind of do have, like, sub-brands, but there's a lot of overlap among them. And they all, you know, are fairly... broad scope ecology journals, and then there are a whole bunch of like really good you know, more specialized journals too. I don't know, I just like, maybe there I'm sure there are ecologists that have more like less amorphous interests than I have, and maybe they find, like, they do find themselves submitting to the same few places over and over again. But I don't know. That's not something that I've seen from, like, from my own work.
And I gotta say, as an early career person, at least early on, I was being advised to not submit to the same places over and over again, and to really make sure that I picked a breadth of journals and audiences, which would make me more competitive for the job market. So there's that consideration too.
Yeah, I got similar advice.
Yeah. But I mean, if you can do 10 papers in ecology, good on you. But
I just wonder, there's got to be like super specialized fields, right? And there's just, it's more limited, right? Or is it just because there's a billion journals and it doesn't matter anyway?
No, I think there's probably some specialized field stuff. I don't know about an ecology. So my dad is a research development scientist at a major medical company. And long story short, he ended up starting a journal that was just about soft errors in medical implantable devices. And it's still going. And and like publishes regularly. And that seems extremely niche to me. Like, I've told him that before. I'm like, who's publishing? And he's like, well, you know, there's a group of us. So they're out there.
I was reading the abstract to an article for the MDPI journal Beverages today that talked about how to do carbonation in a way in seltzer water that was more commercially friendly, like what it was that consumers wanted when they opened a drink, and like had mouthfeel, and like how to make like the carbonation injected into the bubbles to make the bubbles the perfect shape so that it like was crisp and in your mouth. I was like, that's on point right there.
That's amazing.
It's bonkers.
I'm gonna think about that. I know, when I make a gin and tonic later. Huh, who knew? So
it's like a
I
was gonna say, like, there's this book called The Dorito Effect that talks about like how engineered food is to be more of an experience.
Jeez.
So when you think about things like Doritos and Pringles and whatnot, like all the engineering and science that goes in to like the sound that when you open the bag, the sound when you make the crunch, the mouth feel, like all of these things, these textures and sensations and experiences that go beyond just what the food is to create that experience. So you know, like what an Oreo is or something, I don't know, like all the things that's in like highly engineered, highly, you know, food. Like they're really kind of like technological marvels.
So making a terrible segue here.
Absolutely.
MDPI is a, you know, pay-to-publish publisher. And, you know, there's some reasons that people might want to kind of subvert that that model, because, you know, it's expensive. It puts the cost on researchers. I don't know that overall it's any more or less expensive, but it means that researchers incur the cost of publishing, as opposed to libraries who, you know, subscribe to journals and that sort of thing. You know, do you think preprints are an effective way to subvert that model?
I do. Like, I was talking to somebody the other day about how, like, yeah, submit to whatever, but then, like, when you do the preprint, like, put the preprint out, when you put it in, and make sure it's very well publicized, and the links are, you know, everywhere that you can see stuff, so, like, it goes into the higher tier journal or et cetera, but also, like, the preprints are there and freely accessible and something people can get to. So
but maybe two caveats to that, I guess I would offer, is number one, now you're, instead of talking about, you know, like, physical, like, money capital for getting something published or whatever, now you're talking about social capital, being able to advertise it, right, and having a network with which to put it out there. And then number two, you're talking, preprints don't have peer review. They're preprints, right? They're pre-peer review. So, but are you talking about instead, like, when you take the already peer-reviewed, it just hasn't been formatted, and stick that on the preprint server? So it's open.
It's most journals, you can publicly archive the peer-reviewed version. It's just you can't publicly archive typically the typeset version.
Right. So, I guess it's the like non, you know, are you suggesting, Jeff, or maybe I'm not understanding about like preprint, like why even publish or pay to publish, just put it out on preprint servers? That might be a little hyperbolic.
Maybe I was misunderstanding what this person was saying, but maybe that's what they're talking about, just like preprint the, you know, peer-reviewed version and put it out there and just be like, you know, have access to it if you want. That said, like, I don't troll preprint servers, do you? In fact, actually, this week has been one of the only times that I've went to a preprint server, and that's because of another issue that's been in ecology this week.
Yeah, I know the issue you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's...
I guess the... My question, at least like the intent of it, like I get, you know, how you know that like posting on a preprint server can help disseminate an article widely. But I was kind of thinking it like, is that, could that ever be sort of a replacement for, you know, publishing in journals as a way of avoiding the, you know, the costs of publication?
I have thoughts on this, and it's going to come out sounding political. Libertarians tried this thing where they tried to get rid of, you know, fiat currencies and money and whatnot in like New England, and had this market where they're, we're just going to trade gold directly. And so, you know, the first year they do this, they, it kind of works, and they're on this like barter system, right? But everyone's really into the gold thing. Gold like shoots up in money. And so they end up like trying to make this transaction where they're like shaving off like little teeny tiny slivers of gold to buy like dozens of eggs and like sides of bacon, like little things, like little things. And eventually what somebody does is take the little slivers of gold and start putting them in, you know, like plastic. So it's wrapped up like little cards, almost like dollar bills. Because they start putting them in denominations. And then eventually, that shit got to be too cumbersome because you're carrying around these weird, like, saran-wrapped, or, like, hard plastic-wrapped pieces of gold. So what they eventually did was they built an app that then kept track of the gold that you had so you could just, like, fucking Venmo people. So they wanted to get rid of currency and build a barter market, and realized after like 3 or 4 years that they needed to build a fucking currency market and built their own version of a fiat currency. What's going to happen if you totally get rid of the thing out there is that we're going to put something that looks just like fucking peer review onto preprint servers, and we're just going to reinvent the thing that we already have just in a weird way.
And no, I completely agree with you, and I would extend the metaphor farther that we would not only just recreate something that looks like peer review, we'd recreate something that looks like journals that have some branding associated with the quality of the science. Otherwise, it's just the flotsam of science out there. We've all done science that is might be good science, but it might not be publishable in the sense that no one cares and it doesn't advance our knowledge in any way. Right.
Yeah, and probably if you're like me, you've done science is published and isn't very good.
Oh, God. I can't imagine that's true at all, but
no, I mean, it's not like fraudulent or anything like that. Like that's a whole level of not good that I'm not approaching, but like, I don't know.
Right.
I have work that I'm not particularly proud of,
but it's all incremental and it builds towards like a bigger body of things. But like publishing is a way of just saying like, okay, this meets a standard.
And but there interesting that you even brought up the idea, you know, saying like it's not even fraudulent. Then we come up with that idea, but what about fraudulent science? We now have no sheriffs. Now the sheriffs more often than not act as gatekeepers, and that's not okay. The publishing system is absolutely far from perfect, right? But we've lost the sheriffs when we can just post in preprint, right?
We're just going to make new ones.
Okay, fair point. We will, right? We need a currency. But that would also be at least in the transitional point till we realize we made new sheriffs. We would miss the sheriffs.
Yeah. I mean, the old boss will look just like the new, and new boss look like the old boss. Yeah. Like it's life creates order. Order then creates chaos. And then we try to make order out of it again.
Yeah.
Look at the internet. Do you remember like a few years ago when the internet was awesome and now it's just 5 websites with different pictures of the other websites?
And a lot of Nazis.
Yeah, and a lot of Nazis. Look at like streaming TV. Like streaming TV used to be the shit a few years ago. Now it's like, because there was like, oh, you could go to Netflix and watch everything, or everything was on YouTube. Now there's like 75 different streaming channels and it looks like cable again. We'd go from order to chaos. We would just put a new order on it and we'd have to learn it, and then we would hate that too. Maybe I'm the curmudgeonly old man instead of John this time.
It's looking that way. You make some very valid points, though. So I think getting back to the original question, I'm not sure that preprints are the way to completely subvert to pay to publish, but they certainly could maybe be a mechanism that helps level a playing field or helps make things open access if one couldn't pay for them to be.
Think of the external peer review thing. This is, I guess, related, but not... totally connected issue, but like these things where people do like independent illicit peer review and then submit those with articles. Have you seen this?
You're talking about the like the Pure Community In thing?
Maybe that's what it's called, yeah.
I mean, there are other models, but it's like, you know, you like post a preprint and people comment on it. Like PCI is a little bit more structured than that because I think you like, you know, pick a like recommender who's sort of like an editor who's in your field to like, and they look at it and recommend it or don't, and you know their comments and all. But it's basically sort of like all a form of sort of open peer review prior to submission to a journal. Is that what you're talking about?
I recognize that you're putting this idea out, and I'm in a frame of mind right now where all I'm thinking about is the negative. And so I'm going to ask the positive question first, or I'm going to ask you to find the positive. What's the benefit?
I don't think there is one. I'm just curious. Because like what my mind goes to is I forget the name of this because I don't work in this section of biology, but that you know, in health related fields there are those like websites where people like try to tear apart and find fraudulent stuff in papers, you know, like try to find manipulated images, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not Rejection Watch or something. I don't know what the hell it is, but it's like this like listserv or something where like medical related research a lot of times will go, and there are a lot of particularly early career researchers who are very cutthroat and look for any reason to like tear these things apart. And so I don't know, like I feel like there's a bad underbelly in some aspects of research out there that we don't necessarily have in our field. And I'm just, I don't know, just thinking out loud, like this whole external peer review thing, I see it as something that becomes like, what if this becomes like a paid thing? And if you only have people who are volunteering to do this, like who are the people volunteering to just do open peer review on just random papers on the internet? Like what's the motivation
there?
That's
maybe the thing I was thinking of is my initial reaction. I was like, who has the time for this with all the other things that we have to do? But I mean, constructive criticism at any level in the writing, you know, developing your science, doing your science, writing up your science, publishing it is really helpful. But this sort of crowdsourced constructive criticism seems like a really, maybe not the most efficient way to go about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot where this comes from is like people who really want to subvert this model that we currently have where, you know, publishers really make a lot of money off of providing a certain level of service, but relying a lot on unpaid labor of reviewers and editors. You know, there are worthwhile questions to ask about the fairness of that model, and whether we can do it better. You know, and so I guess the idea is that if we created a sort of, you know, community culture within a field where, you know, this was normal, you know, to do and stuff like that, that eventually this type of thing could be kind of self-sustaining. But I think we're a long way from that. And I think that it's important to have, I think, structures that are in place. While the structures don't always work well, or well for everybody, kind of do help make the system work in a way that, you know, these sort of like more anarchical approaches to doing review and publication, they rely a lot on people acting in good faith and participating in a at least neutral, if not positive, way. I know that it's hard to find reviewers and stuff like that. Like, I certainly have trouble finding reviewers for manuscripts that I handle oftentimes. But I do think, like, there is a sort of, like, culture of prestige of reviewing for journals and, you know, an importance of, like, you know, contributing to not just science broadly, but like your scientific society that you're a part of, that helps motivate people to act altruistically, insofar as reviewing a manuscript is an altruistic act. It certainly is to some extent. To do it well and thoroughly and not be an asshole.
Yeah. There's the key.
I think it's part of the job. Yeah, don't be an asshole, though.
Yeah. Darn right.
Oh, gosh. Y'all, I don't know. This has been a good conversation, though. It definitely went in ways that I was not fully anticipating.
Yeah, well, and while we didn't solve the publishing problem, I think we have brought up some interesting points.
Moved it a little bit forward, though. A little bit. Do you know the good news, though, that I do have from this week? Because basically this week was, otherwise was pretty trash. Someone stole my front license plate the other day. Virginia, you have two license plates. You have one on the front and one on the back. So I had to report it stolen because I don't know what the hell they're doing with it. But I had to get a new one. Virginia, it's only $10 for a personalized license plate. Guess what license plate was available?
Tree killer.
Too many letters. I should have checked that one. But literally just lasers.
Nice.
Nice. I like it.
It's in the mail. Should be here next week. I'm totally
stoked.
That's
fantastic.
How did you spell it? Just straight up normal? Just
regular lasers. I didn't have to change anything.
Wow.
I know. I know. It's like winning the lottery, man. Like, I got at least got that going for me.
Did you get, like, did you just get, like, the regular, like, blue and white Virginia plate with a...
Oh, hell no. No, I spent the extra $25 and got the Shenandoah National Park with the badass bear on it. So it's
oh,
a bear.
I love the bear.
That says lasers.
I love the bear.
However, like, there was a minute where I thought about getting the horse enthusiast. With the horse on it. But, like, I don't really even like horses all that much. And there was another one that said Tobacco Heritage. I thought that one was cool.
I think you made the right call, man. I think also, the bear takes the cake.
Well, with that, you can find us on Instagram as well as on Twitter at @major_revisions. Thanks for listening. And as always, share this podcast with a friend, right? Sharing is caring. You can find us on your favorite podcast platforms. And we'll connect with you again soon. Thanks. You.